Welcome to Oak City Church, a family of learners, lovers, and givers sent. For more information, visit us online at oakcitychurch.com. Let us know if we can help you in any way. Thank you for listening.
Thanks for being here this morning. We are, as Jake said, and I've mentioned the last few weeks, we're starting a new series in the Old Testament book of Ecclesiastes. And so I've spent a lot of time this summer reading Ecclesiastes and reading books about Ecclesiastes and listening to people talk about Ecclesiastes, and have gotten a lot more out of that than I think I expected to get out of it. And it's spoken to me in ways that I didn't expect it to speak to me. And I'm trusting that God's going to do that for you guys as well. I decided to title the series Finding Contentment in a Restless World because I really believe that it offers that in a way that I've just never seen it before. And do we need contentment, and do we live in a restless world? We do. I think there's probably a ton of ways that I could make that case. But let me just ask you, like, when I say a restless world, what comes to mind for you? Like, what evidence is there that we live in a world that's just a restless world? What comes to mind? Yes. Yeah, absolutely. The cell phone is always there promising something better. I don't know how you guys sit through sermons for who knows how long with that thing right there. You should leave your cell phone in the car. That's what I would need to do if I was in your place every single week. I listen to stuff, but I listen to it while I'm driving in the car doing something else. What else like makes you think we live in a restless world? Yeah, we're crazy busy. We're crazy busy. And sometimes it's a good busy, but sometimes it's not a good busy. What else? Can't sleep. Yeah. I mean, I hear that a lot and experience it a lot. Like, just have trouble either getting to sleep, or you wake up and can't get back to sleep, and just things are running. What, someone over here said something? Same thing. Oh, yeah, insomnia. What else? Yeah, we have suicide rates are going up. The average life expectancy in the United States is going down over the past few years. And people attribute that in part to suicide, in part to, like, opioid, you know, the number of opioid deaths that have happened. And so that's definitely, I think you could argue there's a mental health crisis. Like, more and more people are experiencing that. And I don't want to diminish that in any way, shape, or form. I also, like, think that has something to do with just where our culture has gone and where it's headed. What else comes to mind? Pardon me? Yeah. Yeah. You guys are hitting on all of them. Okay, I'm going to pause my message for just a second, because something else is happening this week that's a big deal, and I was going to say this, but then he walked out of the room. Alan, what happens this week?
I don't know what.
Sunika turns 10 years old.
Oh, yeah.
Woo! Yeah.
So, guys, we got about maybe a table left for the big event. I think we got like 200 people coming. So if you want to come, we can put together one more Oak City table. Come see.
Hey, it's Josh and Betty. Yeah. Are you kidding me? I didn't know you guys were here. Oh, that's exciting. Yeah, and we've got an Oak City table. We've got some seats at that. So if you want to come, when is that? I should know this. Thursday night. And it's downtown at Christ the King. If you are interested in coming to that, it's going to be a great night. And we'd love to have you there, but we're just excited. I'm excited that Josh and Betty are here. I guess I knew that, but I didn't realize they were here already. And just excited for what God has done. I was down there a few weeks ago, and just seeing over time how God has worked in and through Sunika there's a handful of times down there. I teared up just seeing what God has done, and it's amazing. So, and we got a chance to be a part of that. So, there you go. Okay, back to the sermon. We live in a restless world. Access to everything and anything, and consumerism. So I saw this. I saw this the other day. I'm a big fan. This is Lidl. Has anybody shopped at Lidl before? I'm a big fan of Lidl. I am a huge fan of bratwurst. You should be too. Like, the Packers and the Bears opened up Thursday night. I cooked some bratwurst because that's the way that it should go. You should never put pumpkin in bratwurst. Like, what? What has happened? Have you walked into a grocery store lately and just seen, like, we're vomiting pumpkin spice everywhere? Now, I've had a pumpkin spice latte. I don't really like it, but I can see how someone likes it. But does anybody really like anything other than that with pumpkin spice in it? You can admit it. It's okay. Okay, there's a few of you. I just don't get it. Like, pumpkin spice life cereal. No. That's a negative. But I do think this is symptomatic of, and it's what Scott mentioned too, like everything, and we want access to everything and anything. Well, maybe pumpkin spice will taste good in that. Maybe someone will buy that. It's like your phone saying there's always something to go after. And we'll always go after it, right? That is an indication to me of like a restlessness. Count how many self-storage units you pass on your way home from church. We're vomiting stuff and keeping our vomit. Amazon Prime Now. I was listening to a podcast this week of a guy that wrote a book called Future Shock, but now he wrote a book called Present Shock. Like, it's all available right now. It occurred to me this week, it may not be that we think the things, it's not what really we think, isn't that the things are going to make us content, but it's our ability to have anything, like our control that we think we're banking on is going to make us content. So we do live in a restless world, and we're a restless people. We have a hard time finding rest. We're busy, but we don't, it's probably not a good busy. I read an article this week on LinkedIn about a guy who, he sold his company and like made millions of dollars. And 3 weeks later, one of his twin 8-year-old sons died of a seizure disorder. Really, really rare. I mean, that he would die, died in his sleep. And so he's asking these Solomon-like questions of, what does any of this matter? And he's like, none of it matters. Just a perspective shaking article. I saw a quote this week from Chip Gaines. What's that TV show? Fixer Upper. I don't watch a lot of HGTV. It's a good tip. I just don't watch a lot of it. But he said, hey, when you're working, work. And when you're resting, rest. But stop pretending that you're doing both. I thought that's a good word. We have trouble dialing it back and resting. And the phone is a big, like, there's always something in there. There's always the promise. How many of you, first thing when you wake up in the morning, you stare at your phone? Like, I do, and I don't want to, but I do. There's something there. There is a refrain throughout the book of Ecclesiastes. He'll go through some stuff, and then he'll come to a conclusion, and it happens over and over again. And here is how it goes. And so I'm going to read a bunch of these. Just hang with me. So a bunch of stuff, then he concludes, there's nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God, for apart from God, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? Nothing better than he should eat and drink, find enjoyment in his toil. I perceived a few verses later that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live, also that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in his toil. This is God's gift to man. And so you read that, and I'm going to read a few more. We get a little typo there. He's not cursing in there. I mean, he might curse somewhere in Ecclesiastes, but not there. Thank you. He should take pleasure in his toil. Like, that just seems like contradictory language, because there's toil. And so he's admitting, like, things are hard, you know, but you should take pleasure in your toil. And so you really wonder, and people wonder this about Solomon, is he a complete cynic? And is he just saying, man, this is all just awful. And so just eat, drink, and be merry because it all stinks. You know, is that what he's saying? And that's how people sometimes interpret Solomon. But I don't think that's what he's doing. Like, he's admitting we all experience toil. Do you experience toil in your life? Yeah, everyone experiences toil, and it's work. Like, work is toil. Like, there are just parts of work that are completely inefficient, and then there are parts of work that are really satisfying. You feel like you're getting stuff done, but there's a lot that isn't, so that's toil. But there's toil well beyond that, you know? Like, your house, if you have a house, that's toil, right? How many of your houses are toil? If you have a car, toil. Like, there's elements of toil with it. You have relationships with people. Toil. Like, there's just some element of toil in all of it. Don't tell anybody this, but there can be a lot of toil involved with church, okay? Toil. Things where you're just like, man, I don't know that this is productive or useful or going anywhere. And so he says, man, just life is like that. But in the middle of that, you can find enjoyment in toil. We spend so much time and energy trying to escape toil, but he kind of embraces the toil and says, but in the midst of that, man, you can find joy. And he's not saying that with a wink and a nod. He's not saying it cynically. He means it. I said this last week. I used the spectrum of like how we approach things, and that we can approach things either like hopeless or clueless. You know, like those are the opposite ends of this spectrum. Like everything's horrible or everything's amazing, but we're not really paying attention to the things that aren't horrible. But here we're not paying attention to the things that are pretty amazing. And in the middle of that would be joy or contentment or really wisdom. And you're going to lean one way or the other towards cynicism or towards being naive. And I talked about Gideon, like, and God kind of pushing him and us towards naive. Someone else put that as like, we either look at this like as a bitter cynicism or a shallow optimism. We tend to approach life like that, but there's wisdom in the middle. And that's what Solomon is promising. He says in another passage, behold, what I've seen to be good and fitting is to eat and drink and find enjoyment in all the toil with which one toils under the sun the few days of his life that God has given him, for this is his lot. But again, lot sounds kind of negative, but realistic, and he means it. Like, find joy in the midst of that. I commend joy, for man has nothing better under the sun but to eat and drink and be joyful, for this will go with him in his toil through the days of his life that God has given him under the sun. Go, eat your bread with joy, drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has already approved what you do. Let your garments be white, and let not oil be lacking on your head. And then right after that, he says, enjoy life with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life. We're going to talk about this next week. Vain is like not a bad thing. It's just life is a vapor. It's a poof, and it's going to be gone. But enjoy it. Enjoy what God's given you, because this is your portion in life, and in your toil at which you toil under the sun, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. It's not like just go home, light up a cigarette, and sit there and watch TV. Do it with all your might. It's not taking away your ambition. But he says, there's no work or thought or knowledge and wisdom and Sheol where you're going. Like, realize, be realistic about where you're living. And that's the promise that he offers. People say, there's a simplicity. I've heard this said a few times. There's a simplicity that comes before complexity, and there is a simplicity that comes after complexity. Has anybody ever heard that before? So I guess because I'm a speaker, like, I heard that someplace. A simplicity that comes before complexity and a simplicity that comes after complexity. The church is often accused of having a simplicity that comes before complexity. And I would argue that's kind of on maybe the clueless area. Like, and I'm not, I rarely give you simplicity before complexity, right? Yeah, you probably would enjoy a little simplicity before the complexity. Just forget the complexity for a second. Stop laughing, Mandy. And I too often get stuck in the complexity because I really like it. And honestly, it's really hard to get to the simplicity after the complexity. Solomon is offering the simplicity after the complexity. He's not giving you like a cynical simplicity before the complexity or ignoring the complexity. He is in this book going to dive into all the complexities of life. Like deep, go to difficult places. And he's going to come out the other end and say, man, find joy in it. Because it's a gift from God and God's in control. And that's possible. And that is appealing to me. What if Solomon can get us to the place where we're convinced that even given all the stresses and anxieties of our lives, that God is in control and he wants us to enjoy the life that he's given us. Like, sign me up for that. And I'm confident that's what he's saying. Now, whether I can get us there is a whole other thing, you know. But spend some time in Ecclesiastes over the next few months. Now, I'm going to spend time today just putting Ecclesiastes in context of the Bible, because I think you need to do that to understand it. And so I'm just going to sweep through some things in the Bible about wisdom. Because a lot of the Bible and the story arc of the Bible is in the context of wisdom. The Ecclesiastes fits with Proverbs. So there's Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Job, the Song of Solomon. Those are commonly referred to as the wisdom books in the Bible. And I've preached all of those over 12 years because they're all super relevant. They offer wisdom to us today. But I've probably never seen how they fit together the way I have in the last few months. And the way they fit together, frankly, is brilliant. And I hope you find that today. But it really helps you understand where Ecclesiastes fits and what the message is of Ecclesiastes and what wisdom is. One guy talked about how wisdom is not, it's not figuring out how to do things or how people work or how to get what you want. Wisdom is more learning how to successfully navigate the reality that we live in. How to be in that middle place and dealing with the realities that we live in. It's not how do we control our environment, but how do we live well within an environment that we don't have much control over. And when you talk about wisdom in the Bible, you have to start in the Garden of Eden, and you have to start in Genesis 1, Genesis 2, and Genesis 3. And quickly, we'll see how the rest of the wisdom books depend on it. So this is the verse that I'll start at, skipping a whole lot of stuff in Genesis. The serpent said to the woman, "You will not surely die, for God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened and you will be like God, knowing good and evil." So the setup in the garden is God has created man and woman. He's created Adam and Eve. He's placed them in the Garden of Eden. He walks with them in the cool of the day. There are two trees that he mentions. One is the tree of life. Eat that, we'll live forever. Eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, he says, and surely you're going to die. And so he walks with them in the cool of the day, so he'll give them the knowledge of good and evil as they need it. But there's also this tree that if they grasp from it, it holds the promise of it, but he says, surely you'll die. And so the serpent comes into the garden and says to the woman, did God really tell you not to eat from that tree? And just starts questioning what God said. And you come to this part of the scene where he says, surely you won't die, for God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be open and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. That is the promise of wisdom. You'll know good and bad. You'll know what to do in all the situations. God's holding back wisdom from you. If you eat from that tree, what he knows is you'll just have that for yourself and we'll cut out the middleman. You know? There's always an alternative view of my circumstances. There's God's view of my circumstances, and then there's another way of looking at my circumstances. And so God has said, listen, we're going to walk in the cool of the day. You're going to be in relationship with me. I'm going to give you this as you need it. And the serpent has said, no, there's a way that you can live independent of God, and you can get that for yourself. The question, and this flows throughout the wisdom books and throws throughout the Bible, is can we be wise apart from God? Is wisdom something we receive from God, or is wisdom something we acquire on our own? We grasp on our own. So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, a delight to the eyes, and desired to make one wise, she took of its fruit and she ate, and she also gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate. So she looks at it, sees that it's good for food, tastes good, delight to the eyes, looks good, desire to make one wise, makes me feel good. So she did it. No consideration of what God has said, just consideration for what makes sense to her in the moment, and she grasped. And it says, the eyes of both of them were open, they knew that they were naked, and they sewed fig leaves together and made for themselves loincloths. And so in this verse and in the other verses in that passage, you see that an intimacy is lost within themselves. They experience shame between each other. They blame each other, and between them and God. They fear God, but in a way that they didn't have to fear God. They fear God because he said, you're going to die if you eat from that. And so they think he's going to kill them when they should have feared God and just believed that God knows more about life than they knew about life. And so that's the setup. Before they get out of the garden, God gives them a talking to. The man, the woman, and the serpent. And when he talks to the serpent, he basically says to the serpent, this isn't over yet. This isn't over yet. You haven't won this thing, and you're going to lose this thing. They're going to have babies, and one of those babies, somewhere down the line, is going to come back to you, and you're going to bruise his heel, but he's going to crush your head. And Satan, you're going to lose. That's what he says. It's the promise of the gospel right in Genesis chapter 3. But for them, they hear that, and you if you read the Bible in this way, then you start seeing this anticipation throughout the Old Testament stories. They think, all right, I mean, they hear it. They're like, okay, we're going to have a kid, and a kid is going to reverse this curse and make things the way that they're supposed to be. And so that's the promise of it. So she has a baby named Cain, and she says, behold, this is it. I've had a baby with the help of the Lord, and they think Cain is it. He's going to defeat the serpent, but Cain's not the one. And then they start looking for it. So you get to the story of Abraham, and start looking at Abraham and Sarah in this light. God calls Abraham. It's a few chapters later. Abraham is the one that is the first Jewish guy. Like, he is the father of Israel. And so God says, I'm going to make a great nation out of you. All the nations are going to be blessed through you. And so you got Abraham and Sarah. And so God makes this promise, and it's like Genesis 12, right? This is pretty quick. And so if you're reading the Bible without the rest of it, you're thinking, okay, this is the one that God promised in Genesis chapter 3. Got Adam. We got like an Adam-y type figure and an Eve-y type figure with Abraham and Sarah. And God's made a promise that all the nations are going to be blessed through them. What else could it be talking about? And so the language is really similar. They got a problem in that they can't have a baby. They need a kid to start a nation, but they can't have a kid. And so are they going to trust God for that? Or are they going to grasp for control of the situation? Are they going to receive from God, or are they going to grasp control on their own? What do? Yeah, they grasp for control on their own. And so they can't have a kid. Sarah sees her maidservant, an Egyptian maidservant named Hagar, and she says to Abraham, hey, I got an idea. You just sleep with my maidservant, have a baby. We'll call it our baby. It'll be like your offspring, our offspring, kind of. And we'll go from there. And Abraham's like, are you sure you want to do that? Like, are you sure? And she's like, yeah, that's a good idea. And so he does it. It was a bad idea. Now listen to the language. Listen to the language of how this is framed up. And Sarah said to Abraham, behold, now the Lord has prevented me from bearing children. Go into my servant that it may be that I shall obtain children by her. God's not giving it to me. I can obtain it. Abraham listened to the voice of Sarah. So after Abraham lived 10 years in the land of Canaan, Sarah, Abram's wife, took Hagar the Egyptian, her servant, and gave her to Abraham, her husband, as a wife. She took and she gave. Same language. She took the apple, the fruit, and she gave it to her husband and he ate. Same language. That's on purpose. Like they're taking you back to the story and saying they grasp for it. And this doesn't go well even for a minute. She gets pregnant and Sarah is ticked. She's ticked at Hagar. She's ticked at Abraham. Abram's like, what did I do? And she's like, you know what you did. He's like, I just did what you told me to. And he's like, don't make excuses. Like, it doesn't go well for a second. They grasp for control and immediately they realize they screwed something up. What does that sound like? It sounds like Adam and Eve in the garden. And so it's painted out to be like that. Now God is gracious and gives them Isaac, and the story continues. I'd never thought about this before, but I want to dig deeper into it. They oppress an Egyptian slave named Hagar, basically, in this story, and she gets exiled and isolated. And then in the next book, they become slaves to the Egyptians. And those two things are somehow related, and I'm not quite sure yet. But, I mean, just the Bible is brilliantly woven together at different levels. But they grasp instead of receiving, and God is gracious to them, so they can receive. And so the line goes through Isaac. But you start seeing that, and they're looking for this. Fast forward to King David, and David gets a promise from God. You're going to be a king. He actually uses language, I'm going to plant you. So we've got garden language. And your kingdom is going to last forever, and one of your sons will sit on the throne for you. Then he has a baby, Solomon, and Solomon becomes, weighs a lot of babies, but Solomon becomes the one that's going to take his throne over. And so, again, if you're just reading the story, you're thinking, okay, maybe this is the one. We got Solomon. And then listen to how this story goes. At Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream by night, right when he's taking over the throne. And God said, ask what I shall give you. Ask what I shall give you. God says, I'll give you anything. What are you asking God for if God says, I will give you anything? Just figure that out for yourself. Solomon said, you've shown great and steadfast love to your servant David, my father, because he walked before you in faithfulness, righteousness, uprightness of heart toward you. You've kept him for this great and steadfast love. You've given him a son to sit on his throne to this day. And now, O Lord my God, you have made your servant king in place of David my father, although I am but a little child. I do not know how to go out or come in, and your servant is in the midst of your people, whom you've chosen, a great people, too many to be numbered or counted for your multitude. I mean, this is what he asked for. Give your servant, therefore, give your servant an understanding mind to govern your people, that I might discern between what? Good and evil. Any Jewish person reading this is back in the garden. Give me an understanding mind to discern between good and evil. Give me. I'm not going to grasp. Give me. For who is able to govern this to rule? Adam and Eve are in the garden to rule. Who is able to govern this? Your great people. They're thinking, this is it. This is the next Adam that we've been waiting for. It pleased the Lord that Solomon had asked this. And God said, behold, I give you a wise and discerning mind, so that none like you has been before you, and none like you shall arise after you. And he gives them all the other stuff too. And so God gave Solomon wisdom and understanding beyond measure and breadth of mind, like the sand on the seashore, so that Solomon's wisdom surpassed the wisdom of all the people of the East and all the wisdom of Egypt. He was wiser than all other men, than a bunch of other people there. And his fame was in all the surrounding nations. He also spoke 3,000 proverbs. His songs were 1,005. He spoke of trees and beasts and birds and reptiles and fish. That's a little odd. And people of all the nations came to hear the wisdom of Solomon, and from all the kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom. And so he gets this wisdom. There's a scene where the Queen of Sheba comes up to investigate, because she's heard about Solomon. And so you've got Solomon, who's a ruler, and the Queen of Sheba, who's a ruler, and she comes up and admires his wisdom. And so one guy was talking about how, like, now you've got the scene painted where he's got his Eve. You've got Adam and you've got his Eve, and they're rulers. And so now maybe we have a chance that God's given him this wisdom and he's going to rule over all the earth. Like, the anticipation is right there. Now, it doesn't happen that way, or Solomon wouldn't be able to write Ecclesiastes. Because Solomon isn't Jesus, and Jesus is the one that we've been waiting for. But that's the setup for all the wisdom books. And so then he writes Proverbs, and I'm pretty sure he writes Ecclesiastes. He doesn't write Job, but Job slots into these wisdom books perfectly, and then the Song of Solomon, and now you start to see how they fit together. So Proverbs is written, and Proverbs has the promise of, like, we have wisdom within our, like, it's in our grasp to receive this wisdom and to live the way that we're supposed to. That's what Proverbs is. You ever heard of the law of the harvest? It's like, you reap what you sow. That's the law of the harvest. It's throughout the Bible. And Proverbs is kind of like that. You're going to reap what you sow so you can sow well. And so this is how it's set up. To know wisdom and instruction, to understand words of insight, to receive instruction in wise dealing, righteousness, justice, and equity. To give prudence to the simple, knowledge and discretion to the youth. Let the wise hear and increase in learning. The one who understands obtain guidance. You can get it. He says, hear, my son, your father's instruction, and forsake not your mother's teaching. They are a graceful garland for your head. And if you've read Proverbs, you know that's like how it goes. First verse I ever memorized in the Bible, Proverbs 3. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. And lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him, and he will make your paths straight. Be not wise in your own eyes. It's all garden language, right? Don't be wise in your own eyes. Fear the Lord and turn away from evil. It'll be healing to your flesh. We got a curse in the garden. It'll be healing to your flesh and refreshment to your bones. Like, there's a promise in that. In the beginning of Proverbs, there's Lady Wisdom and Lady Folly, and they're calling out to us, beckoning us to follow. And so Lady Wisdom, and I heard one guy talk about how Lady Wisdom is like Eve before the fall, and Lady Folly is Eve after the fall, and they're still beckoning us, and we have a choice to make. This is just one section of that. Proverbs 8, to you, O men, I call. My cry is to the children of man. O simple ones, learn prudence. O fools, learn sense. Hear, for I will speak noble things. From my lips will come what is right. From my mouth will utter truth. Wickedness is an abomination to my lips. I love those who love me, For those who seek me diligently find me. Riches and honor are with me, enduring wealth and righteousness. My fruit, garden language, my fruit is better than gold, even fine gold, and my yield than choice silver. At one point, she talks about the tree of life. It's all garden language. It calls us back to the good life of the garden, says, this is possible. Trust the Lord and things will go well for you. And then it's super practical. The rest of Proverbs is super practical about what to do with your money and how to manage, like your mouth, how that can get you in trouble and how to deal with your relationships and your pride and all this stuff. Ecclesiastes comes along and says, yeah, but you don't live in the garden. Proverbs has the promise of like kind of getting back to the garden. And Ecclesiastes says, but this just ain't going to happen that way because we don't live in the garden now. We live under the sun. And under the sun is repeated throughout the book. Right in the beginning, what does a man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? And so he says, yeah, you can live by the law of the harvest, and that'll go better for you than it would be if you wouldn't. But it's still not, like, you're not going to eliminate toil from your life because you live under the sun. And just like Solomon couldn't do all that stuff, you can't do all that stuff. Like, you can't live perfectly that way. And even if you could live that way perfectly, the people around you aren't going to live that way perfectly. And you can't control everything that they do or how that impacts you. And so you're going to live within this reality of being under the sun. And so let me tell you how to live within this reality of being under the sun. And that's why I say finding contentment in a restless world, because he's saying you're going to live in a restless world. But there's a way to live well and wise in a restless world. We don't need to despair just because we live under the sun. We don't need to give up. We don't need to live cynical lives just because we're under the sun. But we can take into account the realities of life and still find joy in the midst of it. That's the promise of it. So Proverbs, then Ecclesiastes, and then Job fits in perfectly. If Proverbs is the law of the harvest, you reap what you sow, and Ecclesiastes is like, yeah, but not all the time. Job is what? And sometimes it goes exactly the opposite of what is supposed to happen. And so Job starts off with a guy that God said is the most righteous man in all the East. God himself says that. Satan says, he's only good to you because you're good to him. Let me at him. And God says, okay, like weird story, you know? And then Job gets everything taken away from him. And the book is how he deals with that. He has three friends that say, law of the harvest. You must have done something bad, Job. Just give it up. Tell us what you did. Job's like, I didn't do anything. And God eventually is like, he didn't do anything. You guys are idiots. Like, that's what he says to him. But it's a whole book to say sometimes things go exactly the way they're not supposed to go. And God's saying, I'm still in control and I'm still good. At the end of that book, he says to Job, he doesn't tell Job what happens. Job doesn't find out what happened in the beginning of the book until Job gets to heaven and reads the book of Job, you know? Like, I'd love to have a video of that moment. Like, wait, what? At the end, he says what Job needs to hear. And a lot of times what we need to hear. Where were you when I set the foundations of the earth? Like, I'm in control and you're not. And so you can see how those books like fit together. One person sent me this a few months ago, like we were talking about Ecclesiastes, and he found this a key component in contentment is to see God behind everything. To see God behind everything. And that's a lot of where Solomon's going to push in the book of Ecclesiastes. Let me move this to the end here. Why are we restless? Why are we so restless? I think the Bible's answer to this is that we are grasping for something we're not meant to have. We're grasping for control over things that we will never be able to control. We are living under an illusion that we can control things that we'll never be able to control. We're grasping for life and thinking control will give us life instead of receiving the life that God has set out before. We want to be gods. We want to be God over our own life. Someone had referenced this poem you'll know the very end of this, you'll know it, but if to what extent you can't listen to the rest of it because it goes in the same vein. It's called Invictus. This guy wrote, out of the night that covers me, Black is the pit from pole to pole. I thank whatever gods may be for my unconquerable soul. In the fell clutch of circumstance, I have not winced nor cried aloud. Under the bludgeonings of chance, my head is bloody but unbowed. Beyond this place of wrath and tears looms but the horror of the shade, and yet the menace of the years finds and shall find me unafraid. It matters not how straight the gate, how charged with punishments the scroll. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. We live in a world that puts that up and says, this is how I want to be. And God just laughs at that. You are the master of your fate and the captain of your soul. God's like, really? You're not. And to the extent we try and grasp and say, that's it, I'm going to be the master of my fate and the captain of my soul, that it will be futile for us. That's why the phone, in some ways, I think, always offers that. There's something better right there. There's something. There's got to be something. Let me find it. For a day this week, put your phone down. Put it in a drawer. No one calls each other anyway anymore. You don't need it. You know, you can get your text messages on your computer. Just put it away and see how you do with it. Are you grasping for things you were meant to receive? Who are you trusting for the knowledge of good and evil in your life? Who is guiding your life? Who is the master of your fate and the captain of your soul? There's one, so there's Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Job, and then the Song of Solomon. I can't say I completely get this yet, but what I read and listened to about the Song of Solomon was pretty fascinating. So the Song of Solomon is a man and a woman, and I preached this before just in context of relationships and marriage and romance, and I think it applies at that level. I also think it applies at another level, and so in the context of wisdom, you've got all sorts of Eden language and garden language, and they're in a garden together, and yet the garden in the Song of Solomon is a metaphor for the sexuality of the woman. She says at one point, let my beloved come into his garden and eat its choicest fruits. And the guy says, I came into my garden, my sister, my bride. I gathered my myrrh with my spice, my honeycomb with my honey. I drank my wine with my milk. Like, I mean, chapter 4 and 5 are really erotic. Just go ahead and read that. coming together language. And I hadn't seen this. Like, there's a structure to Song of Solomon where there's, on either side, there's two, like, pursuit that are unfulfilled pursuits. Do not awaken love before it pleases. And then in the middle is this union. And so there's the promise of this union between the male and the female. In the New Testament, and I've pointed this out a number of times over the years, that heaven is pictured as a wedding feast. So there's a bride and a groom. And Jesus is the groom and the church is his bride. And at a wedding feast, the bride and the groom consummate their marriage. They have sex and consummate their marriage. And so sex is really a metaphor for union with God in heaven, which is fantastic. The guy would take the most ecstatic thing we can experience and say, heaven is going to be better than this. Like, yes, amen. That's beautiful. But that union is, in Song of Solomon, it's kind of represented in that. And so there's the hope that these things are going to come back together and we'll be back in the garden as one. At the end of that, there's just a weird passage. So Song of Solomon 8, who is it that's coming up from the wilderness leaning on her beloved? This is the woman. And in Song of Solomon, the woman who is, the way you can take that as Lady Wisdom, is pursuing us, pursuing the man. And she says, under the apple tree I awakened you. There your mother was in labor with you. There she who bore you was in labor. And so again, you're like, this is Garden of Eden language. This might be why we think it's an apple. It says the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, but we always call it an apple, and it might be because they tie it to this. She was in labor with you. This is where it all started. Set me as a seal upon your heart, as a seal upon your arm. Love is as strong as death, and jealousy is as fierce as the grave. And so their betrayal in the garden led to death, but here he says there is a love that is stronger than death. Flashes are the flashes of fire, the very flame of the Lord. Many waters cannot quench love, neither can floods drown it. which is likely an allusion to Noah. If a man offered his love for all the wealth of his house, he would be utterly despised, which is likely an allusion to Solomon and his wealth. And so you've got these wisdom books, and the last one presents this promise of union, of hope. Jesus, at one point, is talking to the people that are having a hard time believing him. He says, "The queen of the south will rise up at the judgment with this generation and condemn it, for she came from the ends of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon." The queen of the south is Queen of Sheba. So he references Solomon, represents that whole wisdom tradition. She came from the ends of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon. Behold, something greater than Solomon is here. It all points us forward to Jesus. And what does Jesus say all the time about his relationship with the Father? "I don't do anything unless I see my Father doing it." He's always in relationship with the Father, figuring out what he's supposed to do next. And it's a picture of what we were meant to be. And it's the promise of what can be now, because of what Christ has done for us. So that's where this is going. I'm as excited about preaching this book as I've been about anything in the last few years. And because of how it's speaking to me personally and where he goes. And it's going to go into some deep places and talk about some difficult things and ask some deep questions. But again, the promise is really joy and contentment in the midst of all the things. And we need that. This morning, I guess I'd ask you, like, what do you need to surrender? When you listen to all this and you think about what am I grasping for versus what am I receiving, where are areas of my life where I'm just seeking to control it and take it over instead of really figuring out what God wants me to do? Where am I the most restless right now? And how does God want to speak into that? And I'd encourage you to bring that to him. If you need to come back and pray at one of these stations or just write something down and say, "This is the thing, God," and like, just now, do it. You know, I mean, not right this second, but when the music starts, but now, today, this morning, like, do it. Deal with it. Come down here, deal with it. And we have communion set up. We've had this set up every week because we have the promise of rest from our work. We don't have to be restless. We can rest because of the work that he's done on our behalf and because of the promise that we have in Christ. And so Jesus said, "This is my body that's been broken for you, my blood that's been shed for you, so that we can have peace with the Father on the basis of what Christ has done for us." And if that's something that you have accepted and embraced who Christ is and what he's done for you, then I'd invite you to take communion. If you haven't done that yet, I would have you not take communion yet. Like, there's a step where you have to accept that Jesus is the Son of God that came down from heaven to earth, lived the life we were supposed to live, died the death we were supposed to die, and rose from the dead to show us that he's conquered sin and its consequence, which is death. And when you accept him as that and confess him as Lord, then something changes in you. And if you haven't done that yet and you need to do that, then do that. Then do that. And if you're on your way to that, but you just got questions about all this stuff, man, my favorite thing to do is to sit down with people with questions and just talk that out. That is not toil in my job. That is fantastic. And so I would love to do that with you sometime. Father, thanks for this book. Thanks for not ducking the harsh, difficult, confusing realities of the life that we live in. Thank you, Lord, that we don't have to come here and pretend that there's not toil involved in our existence, but you hit it head on. And I guess there's a fine line between dealing with it cynically and dealing with it realistically, but you walk fine lines well, Lord. And so prepare our hearts for the next few weeks and the things that you are going to speak to us, God. And I do pray, Lord, that we find contentment in a restless world, that we find the joy that Solomon is talking about, that you created us for, that we find a path to deeper levels of joy that come from you, God. And in that, we can be a light to the world around us. because they would see you at work in us. Father, we love you. We thank you. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.